now. It's time for Playing with Fire with Chef Tom and Stu at the new 104.7 WHLI. Brought to you by Santa Giada Pinot Grigio.
But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Good morning and welcome to Playing with Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Shortell, and I'm here with co-host and producer Stu Schrager on this beautiful Sunday morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Tom. I have to share my angst with you.
What happened?
Here we are. It's the end of June, and yes. I haven't gotten my vegetables planted yet.
Really? Well, what are you waiting for?
Time just keeps fleeing.
Yeah, it's hard to get it all in, you know. Every year I promise myself to do certain things, and I don't know. I've been kind of lamenting the fact that I'm not as good a guitar player as I'd like to be. And every year I swear I'm going to woodshed and just going to, you know, practice and this, that, and the other thing. And then right before I sit down to do an arduous two-hour practice session, I think of 14 of the places I'd rather be, things I'd rather be doing, you know? And I just get distracted. It's just, discipline isn't there anymore. I don't know what it is, you know?
So this angst has been building up within me. I mean, I was actually talking to some friends the other day, and it seems that one of the things that a lot of people got into during the pandemic was this need to be outside when the weather got nice,
of course.
After being cooped up all the time. And it seems like pandemic gardens became a very popular thing, both flowers, fruits, vegetables, whatever.
Yeah.
And what got me going, though, was I was talking to some friends, and they were talking about using their vegetable gardens for cocktails and cooking and stuff. And I said, wow, you know, I always just do it, and now I just feel lost. But I mean, like, I'm told that people are using flowers and vegetables to make simple syrups and to enhance cocktails and wine spritzers.
Yeah, cucumber martinis, and, you know, there's all kinds of savory, you know, things that you can put in drinks, which is kind of fun, actually.
And peppers, people are spiking their cocktail. I mean, I guess a lot of people, you know, do that with a Bloody Mary or whatever. But I heard that people are adding slices of chili pepper to drinks. You know, jalapeno watermelon margaritas and things like that.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, it's funny with chilies that, you know, there's so many different ones out there now. And I guess, you know, people of Mexican descent and Central American descent, they've always known that. I mean, they've used, you know, massive amounts of chilies in their cuisine. As far as America goes, I mean, we're only, you know, we're babies when it comes to the chilies thing. I mean, everybody knew, you know, a red and a yellow pepper and a green pepper, they're all chilies, you know, mild, but they're chilies. And now you have, I mean, you know, Fresno's, jalapenos, Anaheim's, Pasilla peppers, you know, there's all kinds of, you know, chilies available. And what most people don't realize is they all have a different flavor profiles to them, and, you know, different heat levels for sure. Are you familiar with Scoville units?
No.
Scoville is the amount of it measures the amount of capsicum, which is the you know, the heat producing part of the pepper. And so they measure the heat of the peppers in what they call Scoville units, S-C-O-V-I-L-L-E. I guess it's probably named after the guy who figured it out or whatever. But, you know, like a jalapeno is, let's say, you know, 3,000 Scoville units, where a habanero is 3 million Scoville units. So you can imagine the difference in heat between the two. If you think a jalapeno is hot, then, you know, avoid the, you know, habaneros like the plague.
What's the pepper that sort of looks like a string bean, and you roast it, and it's not all that hot, but it's very tasty?
You're talking about the long peppers?
Sausalito or something?
No, Pasilla. I think Pasilla peppers. There's ones that they use for, or what you call it, for chile relleno and things like that, you know. But yeah, there's just so many kinds. I mean, you know, I kind of like a little spice once in a while. But some people just have to have everything hot like that. I mean, I have a woman who comes into the restaurant and you can't make it hot enough for her. You know, and I've warned her a couple of times on things. I said, I got a couple of, you know, I made this so you, it's, this is run out of the building screaming hot, you know, because we have some
something, a habanero?
Yeah, habanero, yeah.
That's not a very spicy
one. Oh, that's way spicy.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, it's very hot. Yeah, very hot. You know, it's not, ghost peppers are the ones that you have to really avoid, like the plague. I mean, if you go on the internet, you'll see some of these idiots eat a ghost pepper and then they'll be laying on the couch moaning for like 4 hours, you know, on the internet. It's like ridiculous, you know.
So we talk so many times about pasta and the different shapes and I guess what it's made of, so it gives it a different taste. So I was thinking about tomatoes. Obviously, there's different flavor profiles and shapes and looks. Mm-hmm. So, like, if I buy an heirloom tomato, why am I buying an heirloom tomato?
Well, because the seeds have been around forever. That's what the heirloom refers to, the seeds. You know, that seed.
Does that give it, I mean, they look different, but does that give them a different taste?
Some of them do. I mean, but they all taste remarkably like tomatoes at the end of the day, you know?
Well, that's what I'm getting at. Like, so, if I go to the store, there's usually, this time of year, some beefsteak. There's the smaller tomatoes on the vine, they sell it.
Sure,
I don't know
if that's
a trendy thing. You got the heirloom, you got plum. Are they all different? I mean,
yeah, there's probably, I don't know, 100 probably different varieties of tomatoes. I mean, they're all over the place. I mean, I think that, you know, the heirlooms this time of year, it's a little early. You can get them sent up from Florida right now. Some of the heirlooms I'm using come up from the south. But when heirlooms are in season here, it's usually like the end of July through September. That's the prime tomato season, you know. And I like them for a couple of reasons. I think they taste great. And they look great. You know, you have that, you know, especially if you're doing a tomato salad, you have different colors there. You know, it just pops, you know, on the plate.
The
eye appeal is fabulous, you know. But I think that, you know, in the summer, you know, I mean, the summer to me screams lobster, corn, tomatoes, and basil. Those are the things I think of.
Well, yeah, for cooking, I know, I mean, you got the cherry tomatoes and you got the little
grape tomatoes.
Grape tomatoes. I mean, I know those have like a snap to them.
It's a sweetness, too.
And a sweetness, right? Yes.
No, they're great that way. And you know, I use cherry. I make a cherry tomato ragu, which is basically sauce, you know. And it's, you know, when you make like marinara, you're cooking the tomatoes down. You know, I have my friend Mike Dorio, he's, you know, he comes from a traditional Italian family where every Sunday they had a big dinner, pasta, whatever. And his mom would cook marinara sauce, and he was always saying that, you know, she used to cook for hours and hours and hours. I don't really subscribe to that belief. I think a quick tomato sauce is the way to go. It doesn't burn the tomatoes and, you know, kind of keeps it, you know, fresh. But when you make it, when you make a sauce with fresh tomatoes as opposed to the canned tomatoes, I think it has a lot more pop to it, and sometimes I'll use cherry tomatoes exclusively. And when I make the sauce, I'll make a what they call a gastrique, and gastrique is just a sweet and sour component. It's basically equal parts of vinegar and sugar, and that's cooked until it's caramelized, you know. So it gives a little sweet and sour effect to the cherry tomato sauce, which is kind of cool.
Are you putting them in whole or slicing them in half?
You cut them in half, yeah. You can put them in whole. You know, theoretically, you should peel them. And if you want to, you know, spend 6 hours with a psychiatrist, that's what it'll do to you, you know. But you got to blanch them quickly in boiling water and peel them. I don't bother with that because the skins aren't really that offensive to me, so.
But, like, I know sometimes I think in the movies when they have like these old-time Italian scenes in Italy, and they're cooking sauce or whatever, don't they strain the tomato somehow to remove the seeds or something?
They do, and I don't know if it's all that important. I mean, I buzz, you know, when I do marinara sauce, because there's seeds inside the tomatoes and the canned tomatoes, you know. And we use mostly San Marzano tomatoes, which I think are the better of the canned tomatoes. And I buzz them down with a big stick blender, you know, so they disappear, you know. You don't have to bother with them or whatever. But I think that marinara sauce on its own is kind of boring. You know, it's like, I don't know, I was in a restaurant last night and you know, one of the choices was marinara sauce with basil, you know. And I guess if you're vegetarian, it's fine. You know, you just want something light and quick. I mean, I've had good ones, But I don't know. I kind of like more stuff in there, you know.
And what was that sauce used on?
Was it
a pasta?
It was on a pasta.
Was it an entree?
No, it was just on a pasta. I think marinara has its place, you know, on Parmesan, if you're making chicken Parmesan or something like that. You know, obviously you're going to have a tomato sauce or some kind of base.
I'm curious. So, because we go through this all the time, sauce on the top or mixed through the plate of pasta. So when it was served to you at the restaurant last night, how was it?
It's always mixed through, I think, in better restaurants. I think that, you know, that the whole, to me, key for a successful pasta is, you know, don't overcook it. You know, you got to keep it kind of al dente. And the sauce is critical. And, you know, in America, we tend to oversauce the pasta. You know, people are always wiping it up with bread when it's done. But in Italy, you know, I mean, the perfect pasta dish is just enough sauce to coat the pasta, because the sauce is the condimento. The pasta is what they're really after. You know, here we kind of, you know, we talk about the sauce. Over there, they talk about the pasta itself.
Well, it's funny. Sometimes when I'm making pasta at home, I don't strain it enough, because I'll either just take the pasta with a fork and pop it out of the water or whatever.
Right, right.
And then what you end up with is a diluted sauce.
Yeah, if it's too much water. But, you know, a lot of times they'll use a little pasta water to thicken the sauce. Because there's starch in that water and hopefully salt. I mean, you know.
So just as far as personal taste, are you the type that likes a sweet tomato sauce? Because I see sometimes there's some that are sweeter than others, and then there's some that are actually saltier than others.
Yeah, well, I think the more you cook down, you know, like a canned tomato sauce, the more, you know, concentrated it gets. I'm not so sure that it kind of masks the flavor to me a little bit, you know. I mean, if you're going to do, a bolognese, let's say, or you want to cook sausages and meatballs in it, that's the kind of sauce that takes some time, you know, because you want to extract the flavors of the meat, you know. But if you're just doing a tomato sauce, I don't think marinara should be cooked more than 15, 20 minutes. You know, I never cook mine that long. And my recipe for marinara is pretty easy. It's just garlic, onions, and basil.
It's interesting. I went to one of the prepared food supermarkets, let's call it.
Right.
And they had some bolognese sauce. And I'm always lazy. I'm not usually going to brown meat and make
sure
my own bolognese. And the one that I got the last time, I usually try different shops or whatever. But this one just came, it was just too salty for me.
Yeah.
And I guess what I would end up doing is taking a more simple marinara sauce, just like you said.
Right.
Stirring it through and then, you know, diluting it essentially. As compared to the times when I find the sauce to be a little too sweet and I use the cheese to sort of
savory it up.
Right.
Well, you know, the salt thing is just, that's user error, you know, kind of thing. I mean, salt's an interesting thing because it's really one of the most important things in the kitchen. If you've ever had, you know, I've traveled in Italy kind of extensively, and in Italy, their bread tends to be not as good as you would think. You know, you think Italians with bread, but they don't salt the bread as much as we do here, and it's kind of bland, you know. And if you've ever had, you know, food without salt, you realize that, you know, there's a critical issue here. And you know, salt to me is, I look at it like a mountain, you know, peak in a valley. So, you know, if you don't have enough, you're kind of halfway up to the peak. You know, if you have too much, you're kind of halfway down, you know. And it's trying to teach young cooks how to salt is really one of the hardest things to do, because everybody has a little bit of a different opinion and everybody has a little different, you know, tolerance for it, you know, or need for it. So it's really an individual thing. And I remember one of my, you know, chefs one time telling me, well, and he always undersalted everything, you know, in my opinion. And he says, well, you know, they have a salt shaker at the table. And my response is, by the time they reach for the salt shaker, they've already made an opinion on your cooking. You know what I mean? So, you know, you want them not to have to do that. That's the whole key issue, you know. So there is a peak that when I salt food, I'm looking for. And I'll do a little, I'll keep tasting. And that's the thing that a lot of cooks, young cooks, they don't do. You got to taste at every level of the dish you're making. I mean, if I make you, let's say, a fish dish, right, with some kind of sauce, I probably taste that sauce 6 or 7 times before it goes out. you know, just to make sure that the lemon's right or the acid's right or the butter's, you know, enough in there. Is enough salt in there? Is the herbs there? You know, do I have enough? Do I have too much? You know, whatever. And there's ways to, you know, adjust. I mean, if it's too much, you can adjust it somehow. And the same if there's, you know, not enough, you can add. But the bottom line is I probably taste every dish that I put out 5 or 6 times. And I see a lot of young cooks not doing that. They just throw some salt in there and then they go with it. You know, well, how do you know? How do you know if you don't try it? You know, it's a critical, you know, piece of the education for them. And you salt every ingredient every turn. Like, I don't just, like, put the fish this together, throw a little salt in and go, you know. I'll season the fish before I cook it, you know, and I'll season the sauce. And, you know, at every turn, even if I'm making a stew or, let's say, short ribs, you know, I'm going to season the short ribs before I sear them. And then, you know, season the vegetables as I'm cooking them down. And then you season the sauce as it goes on. So it's a process, a building process. You know, you're kind of building the flavor. You know, that's what you're looking to do as a young cook, I would think, you know. And I don't see a lot of that anymore, which is kind of sad, you know.
So here we are. We're pretty close to 4th of July weekend, and it would be interesting to get your take on what the perfect weekend would be as far as a menu. Say you were entertaining guests from out of town that were going to be staying with you, and with the summer season here, like, you know, what might you serve them for brunch and what would you do for dinner and, you know, that type of thing. I would really be interested to hear if you were doing it on a personal level. Mm-hmm. Not doing, you know, I mean, I think you mentioned to me off air that you're catering a 1400 person,
yeah,
a 4th of July gala at, yes, at the club, which is incredible. And I don't know how you do it. But again, if Tom Shordell was getting down and relaxing and had a one of your old friends from culinary school down for the weekend out, mm-hmm, east or something, what would you do in a foodie way?
Well, brunch to me is kind of an interesting thing. You know, most people think of brunch almost as breakfast. I think of it more as lunch, you know. I you know, I tend to the unch part of the, not the brew part. And but you have to have both. So, I mean, I would do some kind of a sick pancake or waffle thing, you know, where you have some interesting fruit with it or something, you know, maybe like, you know, a blueberry and lemon pancake or a blueberry and lemon waffle, something like a sour cream waffle.
So is this a topping or this is in the ingredients in the waffle or pancake itself?
Well, the lemon would be a topping, but the blueberries I would put into the pancake itself, see if I can get some. And then I would probably make a sauce of some kind, you know, with the blueberries to go with the lemon and drizzle around. And then I would do something. I like to make, like, this time of year, I like to use corn. So I would make maybe like a corn pancake, you know, with some smoked fish on it, smoked trout, a smoked salmon, and top it with a little, like, horseradish / mustard, sour cream, a cream fraiche, you know, do something like that. And maybe an omelet, a cool little omelet with, like, you know, maybe some fresh greens from the market, you know, a spinach omelet or a chard, Swiss chard omelet. It's kind of fun with pancetta.
So does anybody make, like, an omelet that includes fish?
Yeah, you could. I mean, I've seen smoked salmon omelets, that kind of thing, you know.
But like, would you have like a white trout or something as part of, or that it's just,
no, I would,
doesn't
I would,
pair well.
Yeah, I would get, you know, I would do something like striped bass, you know, not in an omelet, but I would serve that separately, you know, or a sea bass, a black sea bass this time of year with some nice, like, light buttery kind of sauce with it, you know, perhaps. And then fruit, you know, big, you know, fresh fruit, you know, pineapple and berries and, you know, things like that. Watermelon, you know, would be great for brunch. And then serve it with maybe, you know, I would serve a wine with it, obviously, because I'm a wino. You know, nice little rosé or sparkling rosé would be kind of fun. Maybe make some drinks with that, like mimosas or whatever. And also for our, you know, hardcore friends, maybe like a bourbon mint julep or a bourbon iced tea or something along those lines. You know, we a little mint and lemonade. Simple syrup, lemon juice, you know, iced tea and a little bourbon. That'd be kind of fun, you know. And then maybe one chocolate dessert just because, you know. Because,
you know, it's funny you mentioned the simple syrup. I see a lot of specialty cocktails today made with a simple a syrup. I think your microphone needs one of those green pills or blue pills.
It does. It's I don't want to come up with the name of that. But
we need to get it to stand up.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know. Maybe I'll just talk dirty or something. You know?
But on a lot of the menus, the specialty cocktails, there's a simple syrup. And then at the same time, and I don't know if it's an easier way around that, because simple syrup, I guess, a lot of times might be something that in a restaurant they do themselves.
Sure.
And actually, I was in a restaurant the other day. I was trying to think where it was. I was in a place in Massapequa, and when I was leaving, the bartender was preparing her own simple syrup for that night.
Yeah.
But what I was alluding to was lemonade is used a lot. And again, I guess it's in the same spirit as simple syrup. It's to sweeten things up. I guess it's in a little less intense flavor.
It's not that. The reason you do simple syrup is so the sugar doesn't wind up on the bottom. So it's already melted into the water. So there's different recipes. I use like 1.5 times the sugar to the water. You can use 2. You can use 1, depending on how sweet you want. I think 1.5. Like if I'm going to do, I'll take 1.5 cups of sugar, 1 cup of water, bring it to a boil, and then the sugar dissolves. Now, if you took that, cup and a half of sugar and put in a bunch of lemonade, you know what I mean? You stir it up, but some of it would just go to the bottom and you don't really get the intense sweetness that you're looking for, you know?
So when we're talking about fruits and stuff, if somebody has strawberries, there's nothing better than sometimes just, grabbing a strawberry and...
Oh, yeah,
and,
yeah.
And taking it. Either it's perfect or sometimes it's a little too...
Time, yeah.
It's not ready yet.
Yeah.
But, what's a good thing if someone is to take a bowl of strawberries, cut them up a little bit?
Mm.
Is it an interesting thing to put a little sugar on top and let it
macerate?
Come together?
Yeah, I think it depends. I mean, I always taste the fruit. Again, taste, I taste the fruit before. If it's a little underripe, then I'll add a little sugar. If it's not, then I won't, a bowl of strawberries is fine, just with a little whipped cream. And in Italy, what they like to do is put a little bit of balsamic vinegar and black pepper on the strawberries. And it sounds like, to the uninitiated, it might sound like, oh, my God, you're ruining the strawberries. But you'd be surprised how, you start to create that umami effect where you have the tang of the vinegar and the sweetness of the strawberry. They balance out pretty well. And that black pepper just gives it enough of a little kick, that you touch in 3 parts of the tongue instead of 1, which is kind of fun. So it's like having, instead of me playing acoustic guitar, it's like having Cream, you get the 3-piece thing there, which is kind of cool. The other thing I like with strawberries this time of year is rhubarb. You see rhubarb come out around the beginning of maybe the end of April or whatever, and it lasts through like June or July. And rhubarb is one of those vegetables. It looks like red celery for people who don't know.
I was just going to ask you, is that the one that looks like celery with the purplish red base?
Yeah, and it's hideously sour on its own. I mean, you need a ton of sugar when you cook them with rhubarb. But it has this certain flavor that can't be duplicated. And it marries really well with strawberries. So when I do like a compote, if I'm going to do a strawberry shortcake, I mean, shortcakes have kind of been, sort of bastardized into that thing you see in a bakery with all the white icing on it, And that's not really shortcake. That's kind of sponge cake or angel food or whatever they use. Shortcake's like a biscuit, So when I do a strawberry shortcake, it's a real shortcake. I'll make like a buttermilk biscuit with some sugar in it, cut it in half, and fill it with that strawberry and rhubarb mixture, and then a bunch of whipped cream, and then just top it, some mint or whatever.
That's an interesting thought. So you take the biscuit, sort of slice it in half, open it up, and then...
Yeah, and then you fill it in. The strawberry... rhubarb compote is basically just strawberries and chopped up rhubarb cooked down until it thickens up. And you need a lot of sugar because the rhubarb makes it sour. But once you've got the sweetness level ready, it's fabulous. You just take a bunch of that and you put it right into the biscuit, a warm biscuit, And the biscuits I make with a little cornmeal and sugar. So it's like a sweet. It's a dessert thing, It's not like a biscuit would be where you have biscuit and gravy or something like that.
So I need to take a little detour, as only I can do.
Yeah, you're the tour guide here.
So you're talking about the biscuit and opening it up and using it as a platform to serve a really cool
vessel. A vessel.
So in the office, there's been this discussion going on. Is a hot dog a sandwich? Is a taco a sandwich?
A taco, I would say no, because, you know, I serve them flat, like open, you know. A hot dog, theoretically, yeah, it's meat between bread, you know. I mean, that's the sandwich. The Earl of Sandwich is the guy that started that with in a card game. Did you know that?
No.
That's how yeah, well, I'm going to give you a little, see, I am the oracle of useless information. If you need some useless information, I can provide it. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so the Earl of Sandwich was playing cards, right? And he wanted something quick. He was starving. And he said to his servant, just bring me some meat on some bread. It's meat with two pieces of bread. And that became the sandwich because he was the Earl of Sandwich in England, and that's how the name started.
And where did the rap come out of?
That came out of, Harlem, right? Wasn't...
Are we talking about music?
W-R-A-P. Oh, okay. I got confused there for a second.
Wow, you took me there.
Yeah, I did. The rap came out of, I guess, just probably the glorious results of America opening up to all other kinds of ethnic foods.
But is that really a sandwich on the go? Because if you're eating tuna salad on two pieces of bread,
right,
it's always on my lap when I'm driving.
Yeah.
As compared to if you have a wrap.
Yeah, well, it's a little neater, you know, and a good... Well, the problem... My biggest complaint with delis, and I've expressed this to a friend of mine who has the biggest deli on the East End, is that they never cut the sandwich all the way through. So when you're in the car, you're wrestling with this thing. You got your knee on the steering wheel. You're threatening everybody else's life on the road. And half the sandwich winds up in your lap, inevitably, every time I have a sandwich. And I don't really eat sandwiches all that much because I'm not a bread guy so much. But or a bagel. You know, did you ever get a bagel that was fully cut in half? It's always, I think they do it on purpose, you know. But anyway, I guess a wrap's a sandwich, but, you know, it came because all of a sudden we started getting tortillas, you know. Mexican cuisine kind of got hot around, you know, L.A. and Arizona. It started out there. Back in the 80s, there was a guy, Mark Miller, and another guy, John Sedlar, who had great restaurants that were kind of Tex-Mex at the time, but taken to a level that, you know, was very high end. And they exposed, you know, America to a lot of the ingredients that, you know, were indigenous to Mexico and Central America. And, you know, the chilies, the tortillas. And that food is fabulous. I mean, it's just, you know, it sustained people for a long time down there. I mean, you know, they live on corn and, you know, and beans and things like that are, you know, high in protein and good for you. So, once that cuisine kind of hit the American shores, then everybody started to kind of dabble in it. And, you know, you see this like 12-inch tortilla. What am I going to do with that? Okay, I'll put, you know, a BLT in there. We used to serve BLTs with the spinach tortillas that were green, you know. So it was not only tasty. I think BLT is probably maybe the greatest sandwich ever invented. I mean, you know, if you have really good bacon, applewood smoked bacon, you have really ripe tomatoes, some fresh lettuce, and I like basil mayonnaise. I'll make a basil mayonnaise rather than just a regular mayo. It's up there with sex and pizza. It's it doesn't get any
so
better.
So have some people taken that to the next level, maybe putting turkey in it, maybe putting ham in it? Well, ham, no, because ham's already there with the bacon. But I know, what do they call that, a club sandwich when you have the turkey?
Yeah, the club sandwich. I didn't realize it was named the club, why it was named the club sandwich until I got to a club. And everybody, yeah, it's kind of, you would think it would be, you know, self-apparent, but it wasn't. And you know, we sell a million club sandwiches a day over there at the club. And I guess it's kind of almost like a uniform, you know, you have to have one of those every once in a while to keep your membership. But I don't know. I see, the club sandwich to me is kind of three pieces of bread, really. You know, it's a lot of bread.
Yes, Yes, that's so interesting.
And you can't get your mouth around
it also,
unless
yes.
You know, I mean.
And you try to break it down, and you got an odd piece of bread.
Yeah. Yeah, and now they have what we refer to as junior clubs, which is the same thing on two pieces of bread, which is a little saner, you know, and less carbohydrate, obviously. But, they're popular. It's just that flavor combination between the tomato and the bacon and the mayonnaise is the Beatles. I mean, it's just, you know, it's a combination that can't be, you know, duplicated. It's, there's nothing like it, you know. And you can try all kinds of variations. You know, I watch Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives all the time. It's like my favorite show. And I think, you know, there's a lot of people who knock Guy Fieri. You know, I've met Guy. He's a very nice guy. And exactly what you see on TV with him is exactly who he is, which is probably why he's successful, because he's not faking it, you know. But I watch that show, and I watch all these, you know, places that are kind of, you know, mid-scale or downscale places. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way. I just mean it financially, you know. And all these guys, they do interesting things. You know, a lot of stuff is like silly, but some of them do really interesting thing with sandwiches and stuff. And, you know, you can see that there's a certain theme that runs through what I consider to be all the successful ones. And it's just great flavor profiles that match together really well, like the bacon, lettuce, and mayonnaise thing in the BLT or club sandwich, you know. And that's why they're timeless, you know. Classic dishes are classics for a reason, you know. And the reason is, you know, millions of people love them because of what they taste like. So, you know, when you kind of screw around with that, you know, you can find variations on a theme that work, but sometimes you blow it up, you know. I mean, I've seen people try and put peanut butter on a BLT, and it's like, are you kidding? You know, no thanks. You know, you're kind of messing it up. And I never ate them as a kid, but peanut butter and jelly is another one. It's a classic sandwich that stood the test of time.
And then there's the other version of it, which is cream cheese and jelly that some people would.
Yeah, or the bigger version is the Elvis. We have peanut butter, jelly, and marshmallows and whatever he put on it, bananas or something, right?
Well, that's interesting. I do see a lot of young people doing the banana thing. They'll put peanut butter on it. Cottage cheese.
Well, it's a great fruit loaded with magnesium. It comes as its own wrapper. I mean, you don't have to worry about wrapping it up. You know, love bananas. I actually worked with a girl who hated bananas. I mean, I don't know how you can hate. I can see how you can hate liver. You know, I can see how you can hate, I don't know, a fish or oysters or something. How do you hate a banana? I mean, she was like, and really, you know, militant about it. No, don't you ever put a banana on my liver. And how do you go to an ice cream place, you know what I mean? You have to have a banana every once in a while, I would think, you know? Nice little split, you know? Have you ever been to Magic Fountain?
Magic Fountain? No.
It's out in Matatuck. It's this ice cream place. They make their own ice cream there. It's like an ice cream. It's like a Carvel stand, you know? It's one of those buildings, you know, you walk in the side door, you walk out the other side, and you get in there, and they have a couple of soft serve machines. But his thing is really all house-made ice creams, and he has all kinds of flavors: Cookie Monster, Black Raspberry. There's probably 40 flavors of ice cream there.
When someplace makes a large variety, like you're saying, 40 different flavors.
Yeah.
How do they do that? I mean, I've seen these ice cream cases.
Yeah, yeah.
Where they have the I guess you call it a tray. Or
yeah, the
whatever.
Gelato cases. Yeah.
And you know, there's not a lot of product in those trays.
Right.
So is it all about just making small batches or?
Well, I think it depends on how busy you are. I mean, in the summer, you know, Magic Fountain has a line from, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning till midnight, you know, so he's going through a lot of product. The good news is the freezer holds it, you know. I mean, if you have it in plastic and, you know, and you're in the freezer, you're good for a year, you know, so you can make it and, you know, and be fine. The product doesn't die on you. And you're serving it right out of the freezer. It's not like you're thawing it out and you have to worry about, you know, using it. It's in the freezer the whole time. But his ice creams are great. And he does interesting flavors. I mean, stuff like I would like goat cheese ice cream. He makes a goat cheese ice cream with walnuts.
Goat cheese?
Yeah. He does this confetti cake, you know, kind of ice cream and cotton candy flavor. Interesting stuff. My grandson loves the Cookie Monster ice cream because it's blue. You know?
Yes, my granddaughter, Rose, does that. We go to International Cafe in Belmore, and they have a blue ice cream, which I believe theirs is a cotton candy.
Cotton candy, yeah. Yeah, Hillebrand's is still around too, right, in East Williston?
Hanging on. There was a lot of stuff going on during COVID where the landlord was trying to close them down, and I think they were able to survive.
Yeah, I passed it a couple of weeks ago. I saw it was still there because I heard it was closing, and I was hoping it wasn't. And I don't know if you ever saw the Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives episode on Hillebrand's, but he was at Hillebrand's. And they have this, like, basement that's almost, it's like a... You have to climb down on a ladder to get through. It's like a hole in the floor.
I've seen that on TV because they've been on... one of those shows.
They have a pulley system where they bring the buckets up with a pulley, you know. It's like, it's right out of the 1920s or whatever. And you got to love a place like that. It's survived that kind of time, you know. It should be, what do they call that when they have the preservation society doesn't allow anybody to mess with the house or whatever, you know. You need a preservation society for a place like that, just to make sure it's around for the next 100 years, you know. Because, you know, there's nothing better than taking kids out for, you know, ice cream or a banana split. I mean, some of my warmest memories of my childhood were, you know, going to Carvel with my grandparents or whatever, and or going to, what you call it, and getting a banana split. You know, it's just fabulous. Kresge's. Remember Kresge's in Roosevelt Field?
No.
Kresge's was like a 5 and 10.
Yes.
And they had a counter there. We go have lunch. They have grilled cheese sandwiches, burgers, whatever. And had all these balloons strung across the top. And it had a banana split. I think it was $2.95 or something. And you could pick a balloon and pop the balloon, and there was a price in there that you would pay. And most of it was, you know, $2.90, you know, $2.87. But every once in a while, somebody would get a banana split for like 5 cents, you know. It was like hitting a lottery back then as a kid. You know, you just like picking a balloon, which one, you know. It was so funny.
You know, it reminded me with the so-called luncheonette ice cream parlor scenario. Way back when, I lived in Old Westbury. I actually had the opportunity of building a couple of homes there.
You're in a high rent district then.
I was.
Yeah,
I've been
you.
Up and I've been down. And I've been...
How far the mighty have fallen.
Not more happy than now, so that's a good thing.
Good for you. Good for you.
But Kitchen Cabaret
in
the old days was a corner luncheonette in the shopping center that they're in now.
Yeah, yeah.
And they had a counter service. It was like a fountain.
Sure, yeah.
And but that goes back to like 1979 or so.
Yeah, we had Sam and Joe's in Carl Place. And then it became Sam and Ada. I think Joe passed on and Sam took on Ada. I don't know if it was his wife or his cousin or whatever. But it was the classic candy store. You know, we had two. We had Bill's up on one side and then Sam and Joe's on the other. And Bill's was just a straight candy store. You go there and buy candy or whatever and, you know, a newspaper, maybe a soda. But he didn't have a counter. Sam and Joe's had the counter, which was dangerous because we all kind of cut out of school and went down there for breakfast. You know, we'd sit there and have an egg cream and a buttered roll. But it was great because, you know, some of my best memories was sitting at that counter with a friend of mine and just kind of hanging out there and having a chocolate egg cream or, you know, vanilla egg cream. And he had the kind of, you know, he had the seltzer, the handle, you know, he pulled the seltzer and he'd actually make the sodas with vanilla syrup or whatever and, you know, the cream and...
Yeah, they used to have the seltzer.
Yeah.
I mean, it was almost like a beer tap.
Exactly like that. The silver thing with a black handle, you know.
Yeah,
it was great. I mean, you sit there and, you know, you just... And I think, you know, it was 15 cents for an egg cream or something.
Well, it's funny you talk about that. My dad's family was involved in luncheonettes in its day. And my dad would always talk about, I guess it was like high school, college days, that his gang, his bunch of friends, you know, the place would close down and everybody would be getting off from work of his friends or whatever. They go home and shower and pick up their chicks.
Yeah.
And everybody would hang out. And the joke of everything is, you know, you put the radio on or if there was actually that iconic jukebox or whatever.
Yeah.
But it was just a cool place to hang out.
Yeah, it's happy days, you know what I mean? It's back when everybody hung out at the juke joint, you know what I mean? You hit the Fonzie would hit the thing with his fist and, you know, some 50s tune would come on. It's chicks. It's funny. You can't say that anymore, can you?
Well, there is a band now that's called the Chicks.
Dixie Chicks, yeah. Yeah, in the 50s it was Broads, right? It was. I'll tell you a funny story about that. I had a young busboy working for me for a while. So we promoted him to Food Runner. And for those who don't know, Food Runner is basically kind of like a half a waiter. He takes the food from the kitchen to the table, you know, and distributes it, hopefully without asking, auctioning it off, you know, who had the chicken. You know, we have table numbers and we have seat numbers on the table, so we can seamlessly, theoretically, deliver the food to whoever ordered it. So I'm standing there at the pass, and, you know, Jewel was an open kitchen, so I'm literally standing in the dining room, you know, kind of expediting the food. And so I'm giving him, you know, the food he's running to the table. So he looks in the bar and he turns to me. And this kid is like 21, 22 years old. And he said, "Chef, did you see those two broads that just walked in here? It was these two, you know, beautiful 40-ish-year-old women, right? So I looked at him and went, you've been listening to a lot of Sinatra lately? He goes, why would I listen to that guy? Right over his head, you know? I haven't heard the term broad since the Rat Pack was around, you know? 1947 or something. It's hilarious. Must have heard it from his dad or whatever. So listen, let's take a break and we'll pay some bills and we'll come back and we'll chat some more.
Hi, this is Chad Turnbull, a lifelong Long Islander and the founder of Savorian Wines, a local import wine company. This week, I recommend Loyal Hearts Provence Rosé. Loyal Hearts comes from the world's best regions for rosés. It's not too sweet and not too dry. The perfect combo for the summertime. You can find a bottle of Loyal Hearts at Bottle Buys in Glenhead, Bottle Values in Old Bethpage, Bottle Bargains in Northport, Bottle and Cases in Huntington, and Bottle Hamptons in Southampton. For more quality wine suggestions, just email me at chad@savorian.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Playing With Fire on 1100 WHLI and 104.7 WHLI FM, Long Island's own food, wine, and lifestyle show with your host, Tom Shawdell, chef, author, and restaurateur.
Yeah, here's the restaurateur part. You know, the other night I went to a place in Garden City called Plancha. And Plancha is the sister restaurant to Salumi, which is in Massapequa on America.
Oh, one of my favorites. I've only been there once or twice, but it just hit me hard as a wonderful place.
It is. It's a tapas and wine bar, and which is right up my alley. And you kind of feel like you're in Spain. They've kind of nailed the decor. Josh, the owner, was on the show some years back. We had him on. And he's put together a pretty nice little brand for himself. And it's really kind of a restaurant that works. He doesn't have a chef per se. He's sort of, his wife is the chef, and she kind of comes up with all these dishes, and she's very talented. And I got to tell you, Salumi was impressive to me because the only thing they have there to cook with is a crock pot and a microwave. And they somehow turn out this, you know, really cool tapas menu with just that.
See, that's interesting. I remember it as a... they have a long wooden bar.
Yeah.
And I guess we went there maybe for like a charcuterie platter.
Right.
I just don't remember one thing that I'm curious. Is it a place that has a extensive wine by the glass, or is it more a by the bottle scenario?
Yeah, both. They're both. They have a good wine selection by the glass. My only complaint to Josh was that, you know, sometimes you can miss... by not having enough stuff on the higher end. He's very, very price conscious, and that translates into a lot of good wine that's in the inexpensive area, which appeals to a lot of people. And, you know, I think that's part of the reason he's successful, because he does pay attention to that. And it's a kind of a place you can go where you can have, you know, a big board. Like he's got a bunch of international cheese and salumi boards that, you know, like the Spanish board, an Italian board, a French board, you know, with corresponding cheeses and meats. And they're all fun. It's a fun place to eat. And tapas, to me, is always a ball because, you know, you have these little plates and you can order three or four. You can have 10 of them, whatever. And everything is really well done. In Plancha, the one in Garden City, they actually have a plancha there. They have a griddle. So they're able to expand the menu a little bit more, and it's a little easier on the cooks. But it's a great concept because he doesn't, again, he's got most of his wait staff is cooking, you know, for you. And they have a couple of people there making the boards, and it's just a brilliant little thing. I mean, I had a cheese plate, you know, I had three different kinds of cheeses, and I had a bone marrow. And I love bone marrow. For people who've never had it, it's a marrow bone that's sliced longwise. It looks like a canoe. And in the center, you have this bone marrow, and they cook it off, and, you know, they give it you with toasted bread, and it's usually like a parsley salad or something. They had a strawberry rhubarb little, like, sauce on it, which was kind of cool. And you just scoop the marrow out, and, you know, and you put it on the bread and eat away. It's like, instead of butter, it's just like beef butter, you know. And the cheeses were great. We had a caña de cabra, which is a Spanish goat cheese. We had a blue from France. I don't remember the name of it. And a Dauphinois, which is, like a really creamy, you know, triple cream kind of cheese. And it was just a lot of fun, you know. It's a fun way to eat. And the wines are great. You know, the wine by the glass selection is cool. I had a bottle of Zweigelt, which is a red grape from Austria that most people aren't familiar with. It's spelled Z-W-E-I-G-E-L-T, Zweigelt. And the great part about Austrian wines, most people aren't familiar with them, is that they're very, very inexpensive slash for the quality. The Austrians make tremendous wine over there. Their grapes are mostly Riesling and Grüner-Veltliner. They do some Sauvignon Blanc, and there's probably another couple that I'm forgetting. A Weissburgunder, which is a white wine. And then they do Pinot Noir, which is Saint Laurent over there. It's like an offshoot or a cousin of Pinot Noir. And it is Zweigelt, and Blaufränkisch is another one, another grape. And I tell you, you know, right down the line, you know, obviously there's some that are better than others, but for the most part, I've never had a clunker from Austria. And they're always affordable. I mean, the wine I had last night was $33 on the list. That's pretty inexpensive for restaurant wine, you know. So, you know, if you get a chance, you're in Garden City. It's right on Franklin Avenue.
So, plancha. So how does salumi differ from blanca?
Plancha.
Plancha.
It doesn't deliver, you know, it's not a lot different. It's pretty much the same thing. He's kind of set it up the same way.
Is it on Franklin?
Yeah. It's the same. I think it's two blocks north of Stewart, two or three blocks north of Stewart on the east side of the road. And he found a space that's similar shape, and, you know, so he set it up almost exactly like salumi. There's a little bit of a difference in the front, but not much. Same decor, you know, same kind of feeling like you're, you know, you're in Spain. And the tapas menu is great. I mean, there's all kinds of little things there you can have. He's pretty true to the genre of Spanish tapas bars. And it's he was fairly busy when I went there. And, you know, people seem to love it. I think he's got a great concept, you know. He's doing well with it, seems to me, anyway.
Another great tapas restaurant on the South Shore is Blackbird Kitchen.
Yeah, it is. It's not as extensive. Salumi and Plancha has a little bit of a bigger menu, bigger selection. But I think that there's a little more talent in Blackbird Kitchen because Chris is a very good cook. So I think it's a little different that way. It's kind of more, just a tad more upscale, I would think, you know. And there's another one, Iberico, that opened up. My friend Jake Purdy opened up in Smithtown, which is very good. That's probably the best one I've been to.
And where is that located?
That's right on, I don't know what that, you know when, it's on 25A, I guess. You know, when you get through the town of Smithtown, like, there's a diner there. It's the last one before you head up to the highway. You veer off to the left like you're going to Stony Brook.
Okay.
Yeah, it's right, I think that's 25A, if I'm not mistaken.
347 or 25A?
No, it's before 347. So I think 25 bends into 25A that way. If you keep going, it's 25, and if you go left, it's 25A. It's right on that road. It's just past where the old Mirabel used to be.
Okay.
Now it's Pietro's.
Okay.
The next shopping center on the right, it's right in there. I was at another restaurant last week called Kima over in Roslyn.
Oh, sure. Trying to think. Reno is the owner there.
Yeah, I met Sam. Sam came over and said hello to me.
What's funny is he comes out of Philippe, which was...
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
The one that's by... as you go into Syosset... Not Syosset, into Jericho. There's like two restaurants that were... At any rate...
Yeah, Philippe was, for those of you who don't know, Philippe was Stu's finest moment. He booked a Chinese chef who spoke no English. I tried to interview him for the first minute and a half and realized that...
Oh, I forget the
Stratus Morfagen, yeah.
That was his restaurant, and he insisted on coming on with his chef.
Thank Philippe. God he did, because he was the only one of the two of them that spoke English, you know. And I remember taking Stu into the hallway saying, "You got anybody here who speaks fluent Mandarin? Because we're going to have 55 minutes of dead air if we don't," you know. That was fun. Yeah, it's, where were we?
I was talking how I had the nice experience at, and Insignia. Accolades to Tony Scotto, who someday we have to actually get on the air.
I can get Tony in here, yeah.
That would be cool. I mean, yeah. He's got 110 right down the road, but it's actually, and you were talking about the 110 corridor. 110 corridor is interesting. Interesting you bring that up. One of our listeners, Bill O'Leary, I believe his last name is.
Yes.
Sent an email to us and talked about staying at Ohiga Castle with his wife coming up.
It was an anniversary thing or something.
Yeah, yeah. Right? And I started to review some restaurants with him. I did, but I would be interested to take your take on that. But Ohiga being where it's located, my mind wandered a little bit west to Rustic Root.
Mm-hmm.
Who we had on, and I forget the...
It was just sold, actually.
Oh, really?
You know who bought it? It was the guy from Blackbird, Chris.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. The owner, one of the owners of Rustic Root, passed away from COVID. Young guy in his 50s. It was horrible, you know?
Wow.
And then the thing got sold. The chef who was over there, Tom Gloucester, who's a very talented guy, who's been on the show, actually, wound up over at Opus with Tony Scotto.
Oh, wow.
So he's the chef at Opus, which was used to be the main inn there.
So I was trying to give some, I said, what is the name? Oh, Butera's is
yeah,
over there.
In that shop.
Rustic Root is in the same one. I said across the street, you got Rare 650.
Rare 650. Also, that place that just opened up, Maidstone 385 or whatever it's called. That's one shopping center east on the same side of the road.
Okay.
Tucked away, it's a little hard to find, but the guy's doing nice food there.
Then my mind wandered up north to Huntington a little bit,
mm-hmm,
and then you had Melville, which is the north end of the 110 corridor.
Sure.
But in Huntington, I was mentioning Hanu, Besito.
Yeah, Besito's great.
And then going south, you have Sorella's, which is an interesting place.
It's the only Italian restaurant in the world with a sushi bar.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right.
But you know who's I really love up in Huntington, and he's been doing a great job for a long time. The chef's name is Tito, a Spanish fellow who started as a dishwasher like me, and just he wound up I think in that place because he's been there like 26 or 27 years. Is Jonathan's in Huntington? I don't know if you've ever eaten there.
No, when you say Jonathan's, I think of a Jonathan's that's in Garden City Park.
Yeah, there's one in Garden City Park also, but this Jonathan's is an Italian restaurant. In Huntington, I guess it's on, I don't know what street it is, New Street or whatever. But it's really good, really good. He does a great job in the kitchen. I've never had a clunker there, and I've eaten there frequently. The wine list is good. People are friendly. I can't recommend that highly enough. I was there several weeks ago, and I'm a sucker for squid ink pasta. I just love the flavor of the calamari. And anyway, so... he does this squid ink pasta with shrimp and a simple tomato sauce. And, you know, I'll figure out how he does it at some point. But he just makes this thing sing. And it's just shrimp with a marinara. So I'm sure there's some garlic in there, maybe some basil, whatever. But it's one of the purest, best seafood pastas I've ever had.
Really?
Yeah.
And then doesn't Mike Doria play up in Huntington somewhere?
He was playing at Canoba for a long time, which is a Croatian restaurant up there. And the food's very good there also. I've eaten there, you know, frequently. I used to play there with Mike once in a while. I do gigs with him up there. He used to play there on Tuesday nights. He's not doing it anymore. I don't know if it was just they stopped doing live music or he's got something else going. I'm not clear on it, but... yeah, he was playing up there for a while. But Huntington's a funny city, town. And I for a long time, I looked for a restaurant location there because the town is, you know, it's got that, it's like a little mini Manhattan, you know, little buildings, Main Street, all this kind of energy, you know, going on. But I realized later on that it's kind of like that really beautiful girl or that really handsome guy that's a lousy boyfriend or girlfriend, you know. It's kind of that way, you know, because there's no parking, you know. So what looks to be this seductive restaurant town, unless you have parking, is a disaster. And I found that out because a friend of mine opened a place there, and he had no parking. It was right next to the Paramount Theater, and so you had to park in that. There's a municipal parking lot around a block,
yes,
or whatever,
yes,
or up that road. And I get there, and the thing is packed. It was January. I'm not walking four blocks in sub-zero weather to eat anybody's food.
No, it's funny you say that. I was up that way recently. There's the large municipal parking lot, and then there's actually one a little further up. And I got to Huntington probably around 6 o'clock or so.
Yeah.
And I was able to get a spot there. But actually, I went to see a show at the Paramount the other night. When it was Saturday night. Whitney Cummings, she's a young female comedian.
Uh-huh.
And I pull up to the Paramount. We were going to eat Akashi, which is around the corner.
Yeah.
There's a parking spot.
Really?
Lo and behold, a legal parking spot.
You should have ran out and bought a lottery ticket.
Oh, my God. I threw everybody in the car. I said, go get the table, and I parked the car. I couldn't believe it. Yeah. It was just, whoa.
Yeah,
when
it doesn't
happen often.
Doesn't happen often. Yeah, it was always that thing for me. I mean, Huntington, I always wanted to have a presence there, you know? But after a while, I realized, it's probably a bad idea. Unless it comes with a parking spot, a parking lot, I'm not doing it, you know. And the result was I never did. I never found the spot I was looking for. I mean, I would still do it, I guess, under the right circumstances. I almost took that location that's up above that used to be Chesterfields or whatever it is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was looking at that, and that was kind of cool because I figured this is like a little Manhattan nightclub thing, you know, overlooking, you know, second floor down on.
That's interesting. There's not a lot of restaurants like that.
No.
But, I around 42nd and 46th or something, Broadway area, there is like, I always remember seeing this restaurant that was like on top of maybe another restaurant.
Yeah, yeah.
But it, you know, there was windows that looked out, and on top of that, I guess it was like on 43rd, maybe, was Frankie and Johnny's, which is the old speakeasy restaurant.
Sure, yeah.
And that was a second floor restaurant that was always pretty cool.
It's funny, restaurant locations speak to me. You know, I get these locations, you know, pass by my desk or whatever, and they talk to you. You know, sometimes they say, hey, T, you know, you got to do this. And other times they're going, away.
Well, it's a whole weird thing. When you talk about ambiance of a restaurant, and look, me talking about it with you, who's the master, but like these strip malls, you know, they're so modern and like a bland of ambiance.
Yeah, vanilla.
It's interesting because when you talk about like a salumi, it's got an ambiance,
yeah,
and
totally.
It's like really been worked.
Yep,
it's just this dark wood and
transformed. It was transformed.
Transformed is the word, and I find it interesting the amount of effort to take this four walls and very institutional and turn them into a quaint, enjoyable ambient atmosphere.
Very few people have any concept of what it takes to open and run a successful restaurant. It's probably one of the hardest things you can do because there's so many factors against you. You know, you're fighting the government, you're fighting the employees, you're fighting the elements, you're fighting television, you know, American Idol. Yeah, I mean, what other business is affected by Muhammad Ali fighting on TV or, you know, or an MMA match or, you know, a Super Bowl? I mean, Super Bowl Sunday's turned into a national holiday.
Yeah.
You know, I wind up closing on Super Bowl Sunday because it's pointless.
Are you allowed to say Super Bowl, though?
I think so, right? Why is it?
It's like a trademark word that, like, you know.
I thought maybe somebody on the left, you know, decided it was offending people who didn't play football or whatever.
It could be. Yeah. It could be. But, you know, when you talk about this ambiance and stuff, I believe I talked about it before, but Frankie and Johnny's, again, was this historic speakeasy.
Sure.
And they moved at one point to what was formerly B. Smith's restaurant on Restaurant Row.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a real modern restaurant, just different.
Yes.
And in my mind, I have etched in my memory this rustic speakeasy atmosphere, open kitchen, as compared to this, when it was B. Smith's, I loved it.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was because it was B. Smith's, it was that Nouveau Southern cuisine.
Sure, yeah, of course.
And I guess she had a couple of places. She had the place in the city, something out east.
Sag Harbor, yeah.
But it doesn't do it for me anymore.
Perception is reality in the restaurant business. Quickly, we have to go, but you know, I sold 107 to the guy who owned the Locust Valley Inn, right? And Locust Valley Inn was an inn. It was like a little house with, you know, rooms upstairs. I mean, they didn't rent them, but, you know, he had it. So it looked like an inn, right? And so when he moved down to me, to where I was, because I moved to Coolfish, right? So I had that 107 space, which had the beautiful marble bar and all that. And he was like, he named it the Locust Valley Inn. It's just, you know, I get it. He wanted some continuity, but it didn't look like an inn. It looked like a strip center, you know, store between a deli and a post office, you know. And it just didn't work out for him. You know, it was sad. Rob, a good guy, too. Anyway, enough of that. We have to go. So we're going to close the show, as we always do, with Tom's Three Keys to Life. And thank you all for listening, by the way. And that's Life is Too Short to Drink Bad Wine. Treat every meal like it was your last and keep chocolate in your life as important as sex and pizza.
Amano Osteria and Wine Bar has been created by Adam Lovett and Tom Shawdell to bring the feel and flavors of a true Tuscan Osteria to the North Fork. Amano showcases local growers, farmers, cheese and winemakers, marrying their ingredients with the taste traditions of the Tuscan countryside. The casual appeal, the flavors of Italy, and a moderate price structure appeal to all, ensuring year-round patronage. This North Fork eatery sends out snappy salads and seafood, pastas and antipasta, along with a respectable wine list. Amano features local vineyards and Italian varietals from the U.S. and Italian wines. The kitchen remains open until 11 and has established a later dining crowd, sparking a local nightlife dining scene. Amano is on the cutting edge of a new high-quality and affordable dining experience on the North Fork. Amano Osteria and Wine Bar, 13550 Main Road in Matatuck. Serving dinner daily, Amano is also open for lunch on Saturday and Sunday. For reservations and further information, call them at 631-298-4800 or visit them on the web at amanorestaurant.com.
This is Chad Turnbull, a lifelong Long Islander and the founder of Savorian Wines, a local import wine company. This week, I recommend Santa Francesca, a wine produced from Alto Alagir. This region is home to another famous Santa, but without the cost for marketing in each bottle, just added quality. Pick up a bottle of Santa Francesca at Bottle Buys in Glenhead, Bottle Values in Old Bethpage, Bottle Bargains in Northport, Bottle Hampton in Southampton, and Bottles and Cases in Huntington. For more quality wine suggestions, just email me, Chad@Savorian.com.